Hey, everybody. I have an interview coming up in a minute with Joseph Atwell, and it's something new I haven't done before. Number one, it's also a video, and the video part of this kind of helps because I have some video clips, but I think it works as an audio as well. And it's somewhat of a response interview, response episode to this very popular YouTube published by Steven Crowder on Did Jesus Exist? And you know, whenever I do these shows, I get a lot of pushback that I'm a Christian basher, which I never quite understand because I think of myself more as an atheism basher than anything else, if I am a basher at all. But that response and hanging that title on me is one of the reasons I feel like I need to keep coming back to this topic. It's a situation where people are betting everything, betting their soul on something, and at the same time, not really following the data wherever it leads. Of course, that's my take. We'll have to see what y'all think. Before we get started, I want to mention there's a couple of books that have crossed my desk from Skeptico listeners, and they're great. I wanted to point them out to you. One is Long Road to Chaveen, A Shamanic Journey of Self-Discovery and Healing by Martin Stevens. And Martin, I see your book is now number one new release in Peru Travel on Amazon. Hey, awesome. And, you know, also as I'm looking at the Amazon page here, if you have Kindle Unlimited, it's actually available for free. So Martin won't get any money that way, but you can read it for free. And it's really an interesting book. I enjoyed it. The other book is from Terje Simonsen, and it's Our Secret Powers, Telepathy, Clairvoyance, and Precognition, A Short History of Nearly Everything Paranormal. And this is a book that Tarjay sent to me a while ago, and it's just taken a long time for him to get it through the publishers, but it's excellent book. A lot of people have endorsed it, including Dean Radin and other folks you'd recognize, so check that one out on Amazon as well. I'll have links to that in the show notes. So that's it for this introduction. Stick around for Joseph Atwell versus Steven Crowder. Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science and spirituality with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. Today, we welcome Joseph Atwell back to Skeptico. Joe is, of course, the author of Caesar's Messiah. He's been on this show several times before because I so admire not only his work, his scholarship, but his open-minded approach to following the data wherever it leads. Joe, welcome back. So good to have you back on.
It's totally my pleasure, Alex. Glad to be back. Thank you for having me.
So what I'm hoping we will talk about today, because ever since this video came across my little YouTube screen, I've been thinking of you and thinking of how I wanted to approach this topic, because Steven Crowder is a very popular YouTuber. I like Steven Crowder. I think he's smart. I think he's entertaining. And I think he's devastatingly effective at countering some of the cultural issues that are so prominent on YouTube and on the web and in our culture in general. There's another guy in this video that he did. First of all, let me bring people's attention to this is a video that got 500,000 views, had a lot of traction. And I think there's a lot of other videos similar to this that ask this question, did Jesus exist? And of course, it's a question that has been asked a million times, but we're going to dive into it one more time. And in particular, look at this video that Steven Crowder did and see what we might be able to add to that conversation. So you're up for this, right, Joe?
Absolutely.
And I've sent you the video and you've watched it, and we're going to pull it apart. And the other thing I'd mention is we're also going to introduce one of Steven's studio mates there, a guy named Gerald. I won't reveal his last name because I don't think he ever mentions his last name, but I did track Gerald down. Seems like a really nice guy, intelligent guy. He might come onto the show. I've had that kind of dialogue with him, but then again, he might not, and especially after he sees this video, he might not, or listens to this podcast, he might not. But nonetheless, I like these guys, I respect these guys, and probably unlike you, I even agree with their spiritually centered, morally centered worldview. Not that you're not a moral guy, because I think you're a very moral guy, but they are out there Christians who say, we get our morals from the Bible, we're proud to be Christians, and they're representative, really, of this new group of Christians who are coming forward with a different worldview that they're putting forth. Let me play a short clip to get us started that I think will lead into that.
You know, I'm a Christian. I certainly would say, you know, ironically enough, and we got a lot of comments from atheists with Alexa.
Yeah.
I think I proselytize, we all proselytize far less than the skeptical atheist community now.
Okay, one thing I'd add to that, just so people know, when he talks about the Alexa thing, he did this really popular YouTube, and it was really devastatingly effective, over 1 million views, where he had Alexa up there, and he asked Alexa, who is Jesus? And Alexa says, Jesus is this fictional character. And then he asks Alexa, who is Muhammad? And Alexa says, oh, Muhammad is this great prophet who lived from this period and is totally a real historical figure. And as you can imagine, this got traction on a number of levels, both with the atheists, why do we have this kind of difference, but also just from the social justice warrior kind of thing, what are we being fed, led, shaped in terms of our beliefs about Christianity? You know, actually, Joe, this would be an interesting point to hash out a little bit, because I agree with Crowder, and I think I know where he's coming from. Crowder doesn't proselytize. So he's a Christian, but if you watch his show and his very popular videos, he isn't out there trying to convert people. That's the furthest thing. You won't even know that he's a Christian most of the time, whatever that means. And I think we can point to other people. You know, in my world, I've been in this consciousness research, parapsychology world. Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, Cambridge biologist, is one of the leading figures. And he's come out over the last few years and kind of come out as a Christian, but again, in this non-proselytizing kind of way. And I think, you know, we'll talk a little bit later maybe about Jordan Peterson, but I think Jordan Peterson is a great example of someone who gets a lot of traction inside the current kind of culture shaping narrative. Who are we? What political forces are rising? Jordan Peterson is a Christian, but again, I think represents this non-proselytizing Christian. Dinesh D'Souza is probably closer to the proselytizing, but still, I think these are significant forces in our culture that do represent what Crowder is talking about there. And I think what he's contrasting that with is not just the fire-breathing atheists that we used to see in Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and those kind of people, but kind of a new breed of snarky YouTube, Twitter kind of atheists who have a very undeveloped philosophical understanding of what atheism is and just kind of spout a bunch of stuff about how stupid Christians are. So what do you think about that?
I think it's probably correct. I think that the internet has produced the capacity for individuals who are just mean-spirited and snarky to have a public forum. And I think atheists, no less than anyone else, take advantage of that. I would just contrast the influence and culture that evangelical Christianity has. For example, its relationship to the Mideast Wars, with whatever influence one would imagine for the snarky atheists. I would just say you can't really even compare one with the other, because evangelical Christianity is so powerful, so long-standing, that perhaps the more modern Christians, as the ones that you were showing in the video, they wouldn't be as wanting to do evangelical activity, but just the idea that, atheists are this kind of aggressive movement. No, I just don't see it. I'm pretty well, plugged into atheists and secular movements in Europe and the United States, and I have been for years, and I just don't see any new energy coming from them. I mean, what you really have with the internet is just the what's really changing is just that people are asking for evidence.
Interesting. Another point of divergence between our two views. You know, let me start by restating for people so they know I'm not a Christian. And I think religion and every religion that at least I've seen or studied has a lot more to do with social structure, control, and manipulation than it does with spirituality. Plus, I think it also has a lot to do with our very real need for community and ritual that it fills. You know, I mean, if you're going to get married, you do want to have that sense of bringing people together, and you want the ritual of that. When you die, there is some healing part that we all understand of kind of coming together. And to the extent that religion fills that and fills our need for that, that's probably a good thing. Probably all the rest of it, or a lot of the rest of it, this is my opinion, is really about social structure and control. So having said that, I think there's a political side to this that I think is so much in play, and I'd like to hear you connect it to some of the other ideas that I've heard you say, particularly about culture and culture shaping. Because first of all, whenever I hear somebody say internet or the internet, in my mind, it's kind of already we're missing the point. There's no such thing as the internet. There's just, you can substitute our culture for internet in just about every case. It's who we are, who we think we are, what are these ideas that are driving our society. That's what we're really talking about. As you've dug into and exposed so beautifully, there's always manipulation at play in that culture shaping kind of thing. Right now, one of the things that I have heard you talk about, and I think a lot of people miss the boat on this, because there really is only one geopolitical question, and that is globalism versus everything else. So there's a group of people who believe that a one world state where control is amassed by a few number of people who can set the tone for everyone else, they think that that is ultimately the best way to run this planet. And I don't want to totally disparage that idea, because I think some people can put that forward in a somewhat legitimate way. We all understand that people in the world are suffering in ways that we're not in favor of, and there's exploitation. And a lot of people look at that and they say, gee, the only solution for that is a move towards this globalism. But there's this other political force, which is everything else. So we can call it nationalism. We can call it libertarianism. We can call it any number of things, alt-right, which I don't identify with any of those. I'm just looking at the overall pattern and saying, this movement against globalism is being driven by people like Steven Crowder, Jordan Peterson, the other folks that I mentioned, if not driven by, if that's the wrong word, it's being fueled by, it's finding a voice through these people who are saying, I know one thing for sure, I don't want to go down the globalist path. And the globalist path and the atheist path are intertwined and have been intertwined for the last 20 years. They're almost impossible to separate. So I've laid kind of a lot on the table. What do you think about some of that, Joe?
I don't agree with it. I don't think there's any entwining between atheism and globalism.
Philosophically, I'm not talking about organizations, cross-fertilizing each other. I'm talking about philosophically. It's a lot easier to get to globalism if I say, you're a biological robot in a meaningless universe, Joe. you really are not more. There isn't a spiritual essence to you that we have to worry about. There isn't a moral imperative that we have to worry about. Forget all that. What we basically have to do is manage your resource utilization and distribution and that kind of stuff.
I see your point. I just don't think it's correct. I think that that there are atheists on both sides of the question, and that, you know, the idea about the existence of God is seldom in play. I actually think that many of the globalists are sort of quasi-spiritualists. I think if you looked at like the recent spirit cooking, you know, rumors. Well, the spirit cooking is real enough. I mean, whether or not, you know, the context that it came up in is correct, I don't know. But, you know.
What do you think the context is that it came up?
It came up in Pizzagate, you know, with the WikiLeaks. You suddenly found out that Maria Abramovich was inviting the Clintons and Podesta to these spirit cooking dinners.
Let's dive off into that. Something that I thought going into this, I thought I would not do, but let's dive into that because that's such a Joe Atwell topic. Tell me your thoughts.
Well, I mean, in the WikiLeaks, there's no question. It's they're talking about spirit cooking, which is, and they also talk about Thelema, and that's very important. In fact, in one of the WikiLeaks, someone is asking John Podesta for what they refer to as a Thelema favor. And that favor, incidentally, is an audience with the President of the United States, Barack Obama. Now, Thelema is the name of Aleister Crowley's satanic religion. All right. It's not a word that is understood
Some
by
people
common
would challenge you on the notion that it was a satanic religion. I wouldn't, but let's just kind of
okay
go.
But I mean, just however you want to refer to it, I can explain why I would characterize it as satanic. But it is certainly Crowley is relating to metaphysical concepts, Isis. And in fact, spirit cooking is just a representation of what's called the cake of light. And the cake of light was a ritual of Thelema that Crowley developed. And it actually is based upon chiropractics. This is the guy in the first century. And it was just kind of a hedonistic celebration linked to some mystery cults. Crowley has mystery cultism just, you know, throughout his description of what Thelema is. It's they're just part and parcel the same thing.
As long as you're talking about Crowley, before we leave that, the thing I always bring up on Crowley is he's a despicable human being by any measure. Even the people who do biographies on him, even the people who support him, they'll always go, well, he's got a lot of great writings. I would never want to be friends with Crowley. I would never want to participate in some of the dehumanizing, just completely abhorrent thing he did to his closest friends, supposedly. I don't believe in that, but gee, aren't some of his writings great? I think later, if we have time, we can talk about that because I think that's critical to kind of sorting out our own spirituality. And the one thing that I guess I say is, why would you model yourself off of someone who doesn't represent the kind of life that you want to live? It's a like as above, so below, so above kind of thing. If someone isn't walking the talk, then why do I care what they've written?
Well, I mean, Crowley, I couldn't agree more. He is despicable by standard. He was a British agent. I think that the whole metaphysical presentation that he created was, you know, a deliberate attempt to pollute culture and thinking. You have to really to understand Crowley. It's kind of a long process, but basically, the key point to Crowley is that he received a Masonic diploma. In other words, it's a kind of a get out of jail card that the Masons give to certain individuals. He received it from John Yarker, who was the 77th member of the Quattro Coronati. The Quattro Coronati is something that if you don't understand it, you'll never understand the 20th century. It's just a critical component.
And to be honest, you laid a whole bunch of stuff on me that I know because your research is so thorough, even when it blows people's mind, even when it blows my mind, and I'm skeptical at the beginning, every time I've gone and followed you up on stuff, there's a reason, there's solid evidence for what you're saying. Even if I don't always agree with your conclusions, when you say this stuff, it's because you've researched it. So I have a lot of confidence in that when you say that he was a player on this geopolitical chessboard. I'm sure you're right, that he had strong ties to secret intelligence and was doing all this misinformation, disinformation kind of stuff, and just being a player in terms of intelligence. Totally get that. Here's another bracket. Here's another map reality. The metaphysical. I don't think it's a good idea to blow past that and say, well, and he put on all these trappings of occultism. We don't understand the structure, order, rules of the spiritual realm and how that works. We don't know if he was accessing that spiritual realm and somehow getting it to interact with this world in a way that we don't understand. But what we do know, and this is what Skeptico has been about a lot, is that there's very good reason, very good scientific evidence to understand that there is such a spiritual reality and that there is some structure and order to it that isn't fully understood. So when people have near-death experiences, they really are encountering some other extended reality that lies beyond our brain-based, materialist-based understanding of how the world works. So that's bracket number two, the metaphysics. And if we haven't completely overlaid that map onto the other map, I don't think we have a chance. And we don't have a chance to understand Crowley. But the third map that I'd apply is the human map. Tell me what you think about these bracketed realities and my contention that we really have to overlay them on top of each other to understand what's going on, or maybe to appreciate how we really don't understand or can't possibly understand Aleister Crowley.
Well, I think you're correct, and I think that the sort of the depth of understanding that you're attempting to get is multi-layered, as you have described it. And it's just distinct than the kind of the way that I use Crowley in my analysis, which is basically I don't need to, don't believe I can get into his mind and soul to that depth. I'm more interested in individuals in history as how they fit into the logic of history, how an understanding of them creates explanatory power. So I'm just a literary and historical analyst. These are just my hobbies, what I do with my time typically. And so that's how I approach someone like Crowley. As far as the sort of this deeper world, his, you know, the psychological situations with his father, I always, just the way I look at these individuals, is I try to look in their backgrounds to see if there's reason to put what I would call an asterisk next to the claims that they make about themselves. Because the idea that Crowley comes from a Christian family is what is given to us, but he then ends up with, you know, under Masonic control. One thing that I always would say is that if you see,
but are you aware of who his father was? I mean, that's pretty
much. Yeah, it was a
That guy was a wacky Christian.
Yeah.
No different than a lot of the wacky Christians we've seen out there, fundamentalist Christians who have these extreme beliefs. Why do we want to reimagine that back into this other bracketed reality? You know, why do we want to say, well, that, because sometimes that's a frustration I have with you. I feel like rather than deal with the metaphysical part head on, mm-hmm. or at least putting it over to the side and saying, well, I don't understand how the metaphysical is at play here. That doesn't mean we have to then try and retrofit that, backfit that into the political understanding of what's going on. People have spiritual experiences and live their life according to those spiritual experiences. Sometimes those spiritual experiences are shown to be extremely unhealthy, detrimental, evil, whatever you want to say. Sometimes they're inspiring at the deepest level where we all look at that person and go, wow, that person is living the kind of life that we can all admire. So I don't think that all automatically has to be reduced down to kind of this materialistic geopolitical understanding of what that means.
I agree. I look in the backgrounds of people because I've just seen the pattern occur over and over again. And I feel if I don't use my understanding of reality in this way, that I would be amiss. I'll just give you examples. I mean, the Bush family, right? They are purported Christians. You see them worshiping all over the place, but they're also skull and bone members, you see. So I look at the secrecy that Skull and Bone maintains as having a political force. I mean, I can give you examples that are just incredible of how this little tiny organization has influence on our political history. When I see, you know, in back of people who purport themselves as Christian, I just feel that you need to apply that, that question when you find someone as influenced as Crowley. And remember, Crowley casts a long shadow. I mean, he's a crackpot, but by God, a long shadow. When you can have, Podesta being asked for a Thelema favor, which is to see the President of the United States, there is some kind of secrecy, something about Crowley that is entered into our political reality that the public is not aware of. And then at the same time, look at, John Lennon saying that he was primarily influenced. The Beatles are basically a reflection of Crowley's adage. Timothy Leary said that he really got going because of Crowley. And so this is a long shadow, which I don't think, just the idea that Crowley's, mysticism was attractive to people. I just feel that there's...
But Joe, that's not what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So Crowley has a long shadow. What I'm saying is maybe because Crowley was talking to the right spirits and those spirits are now influencing life on this world and this existence.
Sure.
I'm not saying I believe that, but yeah. I'm saying that is, in a lot of ways, is a stronger explanatory model than to say that, oh, the grand masters have used the Crowley writings to orchestrate this political chessboard over hundreds of years.
I just disagree. I mean, I would say,
you disagree? How would we know? I'm saying I don't know. I don't think you could know. How can you disagree with that? We don't know the need for that spiritual.
I cannot. Prove a negative. My sense is that there would be just a more natural explanation of what's occurring, in terms of the political process, in terms of political history. When you look at the secrecy that these people maintain, like high level Freemasonry, Skull and Bones. Okay.
You said an interesting thing. You said it would naturally. Why do we assume that naturally fits with the political and it doesn't fit with the metaphysical? What I'm suggesting to you is that all the research that I've done on extended consciousness and the reality of extended consciousness And the very, very strong movement within our culture to deny that reality suggests that there's a very powerful, powerful aspect to this extended consciousness realm that we just don't understand. So I challenge the idea that, well, naturally the political explanation is one that we should favor.
As I would understand the term, that metaphysics would be outside the rules of nature and the observation of nature. So naturally, I would look to explanations inside the, you know, political and historical systems, in sort of like the empirical world, in the world of like kind of known human skullduggery, things like this. I couldn't, you know, and it would be a point where I think we would kind of merge, because when you talk about, you know, these forces, you know, these political forces, something inside skull and bones, right, that they swear oaths to, what is it? Well, at a certain point, it might actually become just exactly as you say, you know, more of a force that they would define as metaphysic, that they're actually becoming aligned with. However, I just, since I'm not invited into their parties and don't know, you know, what goes on in their oath ceremonies, I can only, you know, just conclude that that's something outside of my ability to understand. And I would just stick with, you know, the normal stuff, greed, power, religion, ethnicity. You know, there could be a secret ethnic connection that they have. I mean, these are the things that I would use as natural explanations.
Don't you worry that there's a little bit of the old story of the guy who's looking for his keys under the street lamp because that's where the light is best, but he really lost him out in the darkness of the parking lot. And I guess I'm poking you a little bit in saying, I don't think you're fully coming to grips with the reality of the extended consciousness. So I keep mentioning near-death experience, but forget near-death experience for a minute. Take the secret government's interest in demonology, interest in witchcraft, interest in pursuing all forms of metaphysical conjuring, spirit summoning, whatever they could get their hands on in order to understand what they knew was a reality.
What we need to do is we need to get to the bottom of the symbolism. We need to get to the bottom of the mysticism. And I think that what you'll find is that at some point, the kind of spiritual experience that you're describing will actually separate from, you know, people like Crowley and
I don't think we have any way of knowing at this point. And I'd also, you know,
I think we do. We have the ability to know how the secret society is using their symbols. I mean, this can be done.
But Joe, there's a more direct way. There are literally thousands of accounts of people accessing this extended consciousness realm throughout time in various ways.
Sure. I mean, that's not an issue.
And hold on, let me just finish, because sure, there's also some reasonably good science that's been applied to trying to understand that topography again, trying to find out what that territory is. And there's some deep spiritual and philosophical questions of whether we could ever understand that, whether if idealism rules the roost and it really is just non-dual consciousness at the end of the day, then maybe this is all folly and we can't ever understand it. If something like more of an animistic understanding of reality is at play, then maybe there is a structure that we could understand that is being revealed by people who have gone over and accessed those other realms. So no, it isn't just what some secret society has put down in their symbols. And with that, you know, we have so much ground to cover. It's just so fun to talk about it all.
Yeah, it is.
I'd return to Pizzagate, because I think what's so interesting about Pizzagate is, again, from this reality bracketing standpoint, it means so many different things to different people. The one thing for sure is if anyone wants to go back and do their research on Pizzagate, it isn't about some guy going into a pizza parlor and shooting it up. And the fact that people have bought into that very carefully controlled story that was used to supplant what's really going on is amazing. And I'm not saying that in any kind of super secret way. Anyone can go figure this out, because as you alluded to, what Pizzagate really is about in terms of its origins are these WikiLeaks documents, emails that were released from John Podesta that tied him to these Crowleyan satanic related spiritual practices. And what we have to do, and this will return to our long forgotten conversation about Steven Crowder, but that's that the analytics is so important. And what I would encourage people to do is take a big step back and say, okay, what's that about? And the first thing you have to realize is it's a total political play, right? The release of these emails 4 days before the election is not an accident. It's a political psyop. We don't know who's running that political psyop, but what we do know is that no matter what you think about Crowley, no matter what you think about spirit cooking, whether you think it's okay if Will Ferrell goes to these parties and cuts into these figures that look like human beings in these mock sacrifices, no matter what you might think about that, from a political standpoint, these emails make Hillary Clinton unelectable. No one in this country can be elected to the highest office with those kind of links to Satanism. Whoever orchestrated the release of those documents knew that and did that intentionally. So that's the first thing I think that frustrates me when I hear people talk about Pizzagate and they don't understand, no matter what political side you're on, to see it for what it is. Do you have any thoughts on that?
You're absolutely right. I haven't a clue. Well, but I'm not certain about the pedophilia aspect of Pizzagate, all of the claims that have, you know, gone down that path. And frankly, it's not that interesting to me, even though it's obviously, if it's true, it's just terrific and needs to be exposed. But what I think is more powerful and clear cut is simply that, no matter how you slice it, you have Crowleyism as an active, spiritual force inside our ruling class. And this is not disclosed to the public, you see. You say Hillary is unelectable because she's engaged in spirit cooking and Thelema, and I think that is true. And I think that this is a, you know, an opening door that the public should walk through. We should try to...
Should doesn't enter into the equation. And again, I'm going to push you because I really want to see where you're going to go with this. I think this is also a misunderstanding of the very real pedophile activity that is behind this. I don't think there's any question. The other thing that comes out of these batch of emails, if anyone wants to investigate them, is John Podesta's continued close contact and friendship with Dennis Hassert. Dennis Hassert, a lifelong pedophile connected to the Omaha pedophile ring that was part of the Republican Party. Dennis Hassert, for anyone who doesn't know, was the highest ranking member in Congress on the Republican side. And eyewitnesses have said that they saw him at these very, very horrific, highbrow pedophile parties where these kids were brought in and then taken in the back room and raped. And there's eyewitnesses that have identified Dennis Hassert. Dennis Hassert, when he was brought before the judge and tried for sex crimes, which he wrangled around to get a reduced plea bargain in terms of what he admitted to, but even the judge at that time called him a serial pedophile and just said he was the most despicable guy he's ever seen, because the judge knew that he was sentencing him for crimes that were only the tip of the iceberg for what he had actually done. And what I would ask people to do is to say, what's the highest ranking Democratic operative at the time, that is John Podesta, doing buddying up to Dennis Hassert, especially when we understand from the people who have really researched pedophilia works and how this child rape, child trafficking thing works, is that these are the deepest possible bonds that people form, because the secret that they have is so horrific and is so devastating to their personal and professional life that they are brothers bound by the deepest, darkest secret. And that is the link between John Podesta and Dennis Hassert that transcends anything political. And that is the reason why pedophilia is such a powerful force in politics. Think about it in a very Machiavellian kind of way. If I was this political figure and I wanted to rule the roost, I'd have pedophiles surrounding me, because I have the goods on them in terms of blackmailing them, in terms of influencing them, in terms of getting them to do my bidding. I can let them all go and do their thing, and at any time I can call them in and say, hey, you're now going to say this, or I'm going to release this information. So I think that's what else is at play with Pizzagate. I think that's what's behind this very carefully orchestrated means of burying the pedophile link of John Podesta, because it's not a Democratic thing. It's not a political thing. It completely transcends politics because it has to do with control and blackmail.
Yeah, I agree. I think what we have as facts that are, you know, can't really be contested are, one, the cult of Thelema is in operation to some extent inside the political class. I think that Podesta's relationship to Hassert is self-evident, right? There is evil, obviously, in back of this. And I also think that the Instagram pictures of James Alefantis are those of a pedophile. That's my opinion, but people who are interested can go online and look at them. To me, it's self-evident. He is
self-evident.
And then I would also say that you have videos of Majestic Ape performing at this Comet Pizza, where she's openly making jokes about pedophilia. And the group that's laughing could only laugh at these jokes if pedophilia was something that was just basically part of their everyday lives, you know. And so it's a very ugly picture. And I'm glad that, you know, you gave that description of its relationship into our political world, because I think that's something that most people need to have in order to understand what's going on. And I agree that it may be one of the things that basically keeps the awareness and the information about, you know, whatever you want to call it, deep state, secret society, the controlling group. This is one of the ways that it's probably kept away from the public, because there are these levels of control using pedophilia.
Okay, I'll tell you what we're going to do, because I've kept you on the phone for well over an hour, but I do want to try and go back to the Steven Crowder thing.
Yeah.
So I'm going to play the We Proselytize Less.
You know, I'm a Christian. I certainly would say, you know, ironically enough, and we got a lot of comments from atheists with Alexa.
Yeah.
I think I proselytize, we all proselytize far less than the skeptical atheist community now.
So this is a point that I think you and I might have a difference of opinion on, but I get what he's saying. You know, there's this new force among Christians who have this political chutzpah now, the Jordan Peterson, Dinesh D'Souza, Steven Crowder, and I would even throw my friend Rupert Sheldrick in the category of saying, yeah, I'm a Christian, so what? It's not relevant. Listen to what I say and evaluate my opinions on these other topics, because I'm right. And that confidence I don't think we've seen in a while. And I think when we contrast that with, you know, some of the, I'll use the term libtard, you know, silliness, there's a certain traction they get because the left and the liberal point of view has been so exaggerated and has lost any connection with logic or reason that these Christians are standing tall in comparison. What do you think, Joe?
Oh, well, I think that's true. And I think that there are a lot of Christians that, as you say, stand against globalism, can be seen in some way standing against globalism because they're trying to retain culture and religion, you know, that they are in the smaller group, that they don't want to sacrifice that, their cohesiveness and their values, as, you know, globalism is just evaporating all this stuff and taking it over with this atheistic, you know, machine world. But I would just point out that Christians are actually fairly easy to herd into globalism. And that part of globalism is that the slaves seldom know they're being enslaved because the controllers are very, very smart. And I'll just give one really good example to show you my point, which is that one of the first globalisms that was ever created was the feudal system, whereby all of the different ethnicities and races, cultures in Europe were globalized, and you had, you know, basically a monolithic religion that was, you know, used as to set up the slave state, and the religion was Christianity. Christianity was the mind control device that the oligarchs had at that time to be able to basically set up a system where people wouldn't rebel because they believed that there would be this workers' paradise if they just believed the representative of the Pontiff Maximus, the Pope, who was just obviously a mask for the ruling families.
You totally 100% nailed it. I just want to move on in the interest.
Okay, sure.
It's a great, great point. You know, the one thing I'd remind people of is what I'm really hoping we're going to do in this dialogue we're having is give folks a fresh idea in terms of how to answer this question, did Jesus exist, on a deeper level than it's normally presented, on a deeper level than Stephen, despite me liking and admiring his work, the deeper level than he and other Christians are generally able to do. So with that, I'm going to move on to the second clip, the Have You Heard clip.
I had never even really heard that position, that people were legitimately out there saying that Jesus was not a historical figure.
Stop right there. Say that again, Gerald. Smart guy, likable guy, taught Christianity, apparently, what Stephen says. And you haven't heard about people who think that maybe the historical account of Jesus isn't what we've been told?
Well, he's not conversant with modern scholarship, where the question of Jesus's historicity is, being waged.
As we enter into this discussion and talk about did Jesus exist, and we dive into the nitty-gritty of their argument and some of the research you've done, I want people to understand and wrap their arms around the who you should trust question. Because I got to tell folks, I have to tell them this over and over again, because I'm talking to Joe Atwell, author of Caesar's Messiah, and a guy who, despite the unbelievably fantastic and influential research he's done, if you do an internet search on this guy, you're going to think he's the most discredited, unworthy scholar in existence. And I have to tell you, folks, it's not the case. I've interviewed a bunch of well-recognized biblical scholars. I brought up some of them that I've interviewed on the show. Robert Price, Gary Habermas. I've even tracked down Joe Atwell detractors, the guy in the upper right-hand corner I found had written this incredibly hostile view of Joe's work. I've tried to ferret out and vet Joe's work at every turn. And this guy, Atwell, I'm telling you, he always comes out on top, at least in terms of all the work that I've done. And that's from somebody who doesn't even agree with his concluding that from tip to stern, Christianity was invented by the Romans. What I believe is that the central thesis of Joe's work is that we have to look for the Roman influence on Christianity to understand that. I'm totally on board with that. I'm not totally on board with some of his other conclusions. That doesn't really matter that much, but I think it's important for you all to understand that in terms of talking about this question of who should we trust? What scholars should we trust? How authoritative is this person, that person?
I agree. I think that ad hominem and appeal to authority are just common logical fallacies that are in everywhere inside religious studies. Bart Erdman talks about the fact that no serious professor at university even thinks that the idea of Jesus as being potentially a fictional character is possible. These are appeals to authority. I think, and it's a lot better just to stand on evidence and analysis and just let the public make their own mind up.
The next topic that I really wanted to throw on the table, which I think is so important, and it's really a stunner when you think about it, and that's the, should Christians care?
Well, I mean, a lot of Christians don't think you have to go through this process to figure out, was Jesus a real person or not? They mainly just give you that and focus on what did he do and what did he say.
So again, should Christians care?
Well, if they want their faith to be based on something that's real, they should care.
The question that I think people have to ask themselves is, am I part of an organization whose primary purpose is manipulation, control, and social structure, or am I following the wisdom of a genuine historical spiritual master who walked on this world? I do not understand for a second how a Christian can claim to be a Christian and not have this question be central to what they're about. And I would go one step further. I mean, this is very Joe Atwellian. If you don't care, then you're so far into the mind control project that is Christianity that you are probably a lost cause at the start. If this isn't a burning question to you, you're already bought into the cult aspect of the whole thing.
Couldn't agree more. I mean, if this isn't an important question, that means that reason has been turned off and that basically you are a cult follower, even though you wouldn't want to admit it publicly. But if you aren't able to defend the historicity of Jesus, in my opinion, some part of your intellect has been switched off that is central to sort of living a rational life.
In fact, there was a rabid atheist.
I have that here. From Huff.
Yeah, read that quote. Why does he have to be German?
With respect to Jesus, we have numerous independent accounts of his life and the sources lying behind the Gospels and the writings of Paul, sources that originated in Jesus' native tongue, Aramaic, and that can be dated to within just a year or two of his life before the religion moved to convert pagans in droves.
Now, let me jump in here first with the Bart Ehrman thing, because this drives me nuts. It's back to what I was saying about the which Jesus do you want to prove or disprove ever existed. And when Christians latch on to Bart Ehrman's Jesus, I think they have no clue what they're talking about. Here's a Duke University religious scholar who seems very keen on targeting Christians for his books, yet he has this very overt, he calls himself an agnostic, but anyone can see that it's really an atheistic position that he holds. And his understanding, his conclusion of Jesus is this kind of nomadic, very minor figure of the time who's this rebel without a cause, fighting this little skirmished battle, and is just one of thousands and thousands of rebels who are crucified at the time. There is nothing special about Jesus. You got a hell of a long way to go from Bart Ehrman to Jesus Christ, Son of God, Savior of the world. A lot of people don't realize that, and it's disingenuous, intellectually dishonest for people like Gerald in this argument to say, well, look at even Bart Ehrman says that Jesus existed. He's not pointing to a Jesus that any Christian could, you couldn't build a religion on the Jesus that he's pointing to and he's constructing.
Yeah, I mean, there's three categories. You have Jesus was God, Jesus was a man, and Jesus was a fictional character. The second two categories are equally, destructive to the first. If he was just a man, then there shouldn't be a Christian religion at this point. If he didn't exist, it's preposterous. So it doesn't matter if a scholar is in camp two or camp three. It's not something that can be used as a basis for a religion. They shouldn't really be citing Erdman in this way as somehow. And what they're trying to do is to say, we can attack the idea of Jesus being a fictional character, not with evidence of Jesus having been in existence and a god, but rather there are scholars who believe that Jesus was a real man in the first century. And so that somehow this would, perhaps daunt the third argument, but should have nothing to do with the promotion of the first, that he was God.
Let me go on to the next one.
Understand, the Bible didn't just fall out of the sky. These are writings from people over, literally thousands of years for the Old and New Testament combined that we kind of pulled together. These are books. So we can go to each one of these letters and say, is this a reliable source, and put it under some scrutiny.
What I hear Gerald saying, hey, it's an established fact. We know where these books came from. We know who authored them. So let's move on and take the Gospels at face value. It's a preposterous claim, but what are the basic arguments that we can make about that?
The statement is simply incorrect. There is no agreement whatsoever from scholars about when they're written or by whom. The idea that it's just self-evident and established scholarship is preposterous.
Okay, let's leave it at that. Now we're going to talk about Josephus. You and I could spend an hour on this because...
Yeah, good old Josephus.
I have these skeptical moments that I really kind of cherish. And I still remember the moment in our last conversation, I think it was, and you were talking through Josephus along the lines of the accepted narrative. And then at some point you said, really, Alex, it makes more sense to look at Josephus as a completely fictional character.
Sure.
And that was just a drop the mic kind of moment for me, but let's see what Gerald has to say here.
Let's just go to historians from the time period, right? In the first century, Jewish historian Josephus, he mentions Jesus in his work, The Antiquities of the Jews, in the uninterpolated, right? And that word basically means they weren't inserted. There were some problems with the documents saying that they had been changed. They were absolutely right that they had been, but yeah. We now have documents that weren't. We know that they were totally fine. He's a first century Jewish historian, right? So he's not a Christian out there pushing his views of who Jesus was,
okay. Right?
So much to pull apart. And again, this is going to get a little bit Bible geeky, folks, but it's the path you have to take if you care about looking at this question in a meaningful way rather than the spoon-fed way that we so often get. Who was Josephus, Joe?
Well, as history gives him to us, he was a Jewish scholar. He had been a general of cohort of Messianic Jews in the war against Rome that began in 66 CE. He was captured by the Flavian generals. He then was a turncoat, abandoned Judaism, and became basically a follower of the Flavian Caesar government. Following the war, they brought Josephus to Rome. The Flavians then had become the royal family. Josephus was given a townhouse in the emperor's palace and was told to write the history of the war. So two great works were produced. One was basically about the history of the Jews, and the other was about the war between the Messianic Jews and the Romans. The idea that Josephus is some kind of independent Jewish voice is incorrect. He was, of course, a court historian of the Flavians, and so...
So let's stop right there, because that's an important point. That's not disputed. I mean, no one disputes that. No. That when he's writing these histories under the employ of the Roman Caesar. So yes, that's kind of point one. Why is Gerald repeating this narrative that we often hear? Actually, Christians will spin it two ways. Sometimes they'll spin it as he was a Jewish historian. Sometimes they'll spin it as he's a Roman historian. But what they never kind of get is this transition that he goes through, very suspicious transition that he goes through from being a Jewish historian to being a Roman historian. And I think we have to walk that path a little bit, and you have to tell folks some of the reasons why we might not want to trust the recorded history of Josephus. We might not want to trust the writings of Josephus, and we certainly might not want to trust the modified, changed writings of Josephus. But let's start with that first point. Do we have any proof that Josephus ever existed?
Well, we have his own claims to exist.
Exactly. So have any independent proof?
No, there's no corroborating, source for the fact that Josephus was a historical individual. He's regarded as such because he produced these great works, which...
But wait a minute. This is such an important point. I'm going to emphasize it. Again, to me, this is a looking for the keys under the lamppost, even though you left him out in the darkened parking lot. We love Josephus because he's produced all this great stuff that we can call history. But we're never asking the same question about Josephus that we're trying to attempt to ask about Jesus. And that is, did Josephus ever exist?
Let me respond to the idea of Josephus as a historical individual. I doubt very much that he's real. And I think that this can be easily understood by Josephus's own words. I mean, Josephus claims to have been not just a Jewish priest, but have been a member of all three sects of the Jews, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, and the Essenes. He would be the only individual known to have ever done that.
And why would that be so extraordinary?
Because if you look at, for example, the Dead Sea Scrolls, you can see that they would not permit individuals to just move back and forth between religious sects of Judaism. They would have executed such individuals. And then beyond that, there's even a more, kind of telling point, which is that Josephus, who claimed to be a priest, after he was captured by the Flavians, stated that he had a religious experience in which God told him that the old covenant was broken, that the favor between God and the Jewish people was over, and that a new covenant or a new testament had been created, and that was one between God and the Romans.
Full stop, because we've covered this point before in previous interviews, but we're going to cover it again. Anyone who talks about Josephus and doesn't understand this point has obviously missed the whole story. So I want you to go over again the significance of that.
It's even far worse than you're describing, because I was going to point out that following his conversion from the Old Covenant to the New Testament, or the New Covenant, Josephus took the position that all of the Messianic prophecies which foresaw a Christ, all of the Messianic prophecies that are used to basically show that Jesus Christ had been foreseen by the Jewish scripture, that those prophecies actually foretold not a Jew, but the Flavian Caesars. Okay, so I just wanted to point out something very important here, because he had stated in the video that Josephus was not a Christian, but this is incorrect. He is a particular kind of Christian. He's one who sees the Flavian Caesar as the Christ. This is a Christian. It's just not the Christian definition that he wants to use, one that relates to the New Testament. But you see, even here, he's wrong. Because in the New Testament, Jesus Christ looks forward to someone he calls the Son of Man. And he states specifically that this individual will come during the Roman Jewish War, and you'll have events like the encircling of Jerusalem with the wall, the razing of the temple complex, the abomination of desolation, the destruction of the Galilean towns, and that these will be the hallmarks of the coming of the Son of Man, which is a messianic description. Jesus is foreseeing this individual in the future. So Josephus, you see, would have had no trouble understanding the Gospels. He would have looked at Jesus' statement as exactly correct. He would say, yep, this guy is right. The Son of Man that Jesus is envisioning is the Christ, and the Christ is the person who came at the head of the Roman army and crushed the Messianic Jews.
Three points that I wanted to deconstruct about Josephus, and we're right in the middle of it, is should we trust the historicity of Josephus, right? So everyone jumps on Josephus as proving the historical realness of Jesus. What I think you've done brilliantly is point back and say, well, really, can we trust the historical accuracy of the guy who is supposed to have written all this? And the counter hypothesis that is obvious from your work is, if I'm Caesar, I can get a team of historians to start cranking out a bunch of stuff, and I can attribute them all to any individual I want or create. So that's point number one. And then point number two, which you were just getting into in a really profound way, is even if we put that aside, what are we to make of the reality of Josephus's account? And the reason why you call it into question is you point out this thing that anyone can prove for themselves, but Christians like Gerald and interested parties never take the time to look at. And that is, Josephus is saying something so radical to any Jew or any Christian that it should make you seriously step back and question this guy's motives. But the third point that I wanted you to comment on, and again, people can get an appreciation for just how hard this is to deconstruct this, is that even if we get past those first two, we have this third point, and that is that the works of Josephus, whether real or not, whether created by court filled with historians, or whether written by this one individual, whether written for the purpose of promoting the Roman Empire or not, is then further changed and rewritten and repurposed for various reasons that people have for hundreds of years after that. So do you want to...
Sure. I mean, the fact is that the copies of Josephus that we have, the earliest ones, are from the Middle Ages. They aren't ancient documents dating back into the first century. So these are translations which have come from the Christian world. This world definitely would have done editing to promote Christianity. So the documents we have to at least, keep in mind the possibility that that interpolations could be occurring all over the place. And there are actually, a version of Josephus that called the Slavonic, which is very much different than the one that, has come to us through Europe. So his idea that Josephus is some kind of bedrock, that his statement about the existence of Jesus can just be taken absolutely as a statement of an objective historian is incorrect on a number of levels. All of which are not, many of them we've just gone through. Again, I just would say that this is an individual who's basically trying to defend Christians from curiosity. In fact, Christians should be out exploring these ideas if they really want to have a deep and well-grounded faith. And the idea that you can just, take something like what's called the Testimonium Flavellium, he's referring to, with the statement about Jesus's existence as recorded by Josephus. You just have to look at the possibility that this is actually coming from someone else other than Josephus. It's
particularly really Joe, and I want you to respond to this. If we look at the broader body, I mean, Josephus was prolific, to say the least. He wrote a lot of stuff that has come down to us. More reason to maybe suspect that he wasn't really the author of all that stuff. But as you pointed out before, and a lot of people won't make this connection, it is completely outrageous, out of character, inconsistent to think that Josephus would make all these other claims about Caesar being the Messiah, Caesar being the Christ, about the New Testament, the new understanding, and then would just interject this little bit about Jesus. Doesn't that just strike you as completely impossible?
Sure, and I would just point people, if they want to see my whole analysis of this, to read the chapter in Caesar's Messiah about that, this very chapter or passage in Josephus, because I point out that the idea that the passage about Jesus' history should be suspected as incorrect just from the context, because on either side of the short description of Jesus, you have passages which are fantastic, which are not history. And I show that, in fact, these passages, which are about a man pretending to be a god, incidentally, so you can get a sense of what is really going on here, that these passages, the passages that are on either side of the testimonium, are related to the testimonium. And it's just a kind of humor that the Romans are making about the existence of Jesus and people who believe in him. Because beyond these three passages, the one which described Jesus and the two that are bracketing it, Josephus is engaging in a very matter-of-fact history of military events of Pontius Pilate, which are, you know, just pedantic, normal, routine reality kind of stuff. And then suddenly you have these three passages which are interpolated right into the history. And I mean, even just a casual reader of Josephus would go, wait a second, this is suspicious. But you know something? I'll bet you like a dime to $100 that he hasn't ever read Josephus. You see, he's never read Josephus. His understanding of Josephus he's getting from someone who is writing about Josephus. Because, you know, if anyone who does read it, it just stands right out that, wait a second, this looks very suspicious.
I really want to bring this point home about Josephus. We spent all that time talking about it to bring people up to the point of understanding the slam dunk evidence and conclusion that you have in Caesar's Messiah. And I'm going to maybe state that a little bit differently than you would. So that's okay. You can correct or modify as you see fit. But here's the point that I think Christians can understand and relate to. The book of Mark is spiritually powerful and poetically meaningful to Christians because Jesus is sitting down and looking out over Jerusalem, and he's prophesizing about what is about to come. Prophesizing about the fall of Jerusalem as well as other things. What many biblical scholars, not just Joe Atwell, but everyone that I've pressed back to that list of I told you of biblical scholars, even some of your harshest critics, will now accept is that it seems most like that Mark had, the way they sometimes put it, had access to Josephus. And that his writing is, quote unquote, pro-Roman. Go research that if you like, folks. You'll find that right in Wikipedia. You'll find it in the sources behind Wikipedia, because Wikipedia is so unreliable these days. But fully take that in. What does that mean now if you're a Christian and you have to accept the idea that Mark has access to Josephus? And we just told you how we should trust Josephus, how we should think about Josephus. If he's reading Josephus, if he's using Josephus' account to write this, how can it be a prophecy? And then doesn't everything crumble from there? And if these guys are then further admitting that it's pro-Roman, don't we have to now, isn't the game up, if you will?
Absolutely. And you know, when I listen to, you know, like the video, and a thousand times when you see Christians describing, you know, the history of Jesus, it's just astonishing that they don't bring in the fact that this era was an era of warfare between Rome and a messianic movement. Because this is the correct context to try to judge the historicity of Jesus, is that here you have something as historically implausible as a Davidic Messiah, someone in the lineage of David, who is basically saying to turn the other cheek. Now, bear in mind that David would not have turned the other cheek to Goliath, right? He was a warrior. This was the context of the Jewish messiahs, is they are warriors. So for Jesus to be kind of pacifistic is completely theologically implausible. But at this era, during this period, leading up to the rebellion that was a full-throttle war between the Messianic movement and the Romans, there had been a series of rebellions. The rebellions began in the year 1. During the period of time that Jesus is supposedly walking around the countryside and talking about, turn the other cheek and give to Caesar what is Caesar, the countryside of Galilee was aflame with messianic militarism. So this suggests that the character is not real. If you put the actual context of history around the character and look at him from that perspective, suddenly you have to question whether or not there is any reality to this Jesus Christ individual.
That's awesome. But I want you to take another swing at it from my perspective, because what I'm trying to do is get in the head of an honest Christian who's followed these path of apologetics, and he knows Mark. He knows the book of Mark. And he went to Sunday school and he heard the story. He's seen the picture of Jesus looking out over beautiful hills of Jerusalem and saying, this is going to happen. This is all going to fall. And now we're coming to understand, biblical scholars are telling us, the person who wrote this has the history book, has the Wikipedia open on his laptop, and he's reading Josephus's account of the real war that is going to happen.
Sure. The reason why you can be certain that Mark is using Josephus is because he is covering the subjects in the same sequence. The war, the lead up to the war.
The same sequence as what?
As Josephus recorded them. So in other words, Mark and all of the different Gospels are dependent upon Josephus. They have a series of events which Jesus presents as prophecies, typically. But they are occurring in the Gospels, in Mark, in Luke, in the same order that Josephus recorded these events. And so that's why you can be sure that the literature is not original history. The Gospels are not really.
Maybe it's just coincidence. I mean, hey, you know what? I mean, maybe they have both. Maybe they have the real prophecies of Jesus on one hand.
Well, then you have, the explanation is that Jesus was able to see into the future. But unfortunately, a stronger way of explaining that is simply that the author of the literature had the histories of Josephus. I think this is a little better explanation. And I'll give you another example. You know, we had been talking about the testimonium, and in the video it was stated that the testimonium could not have been interpolated. But there's a scholar named Gary Goldberg that went through this and say, wait a second, this whole story that Josephus is creating is actually is dependent upon the story that exists in Luke. So you can see that the literatures are entwined. They aren't independent historians or people who knew Jesus, and a historian after the war recounting the events. All of this literature is dependent upon one another. And so when you look at Mark, when you go through the events in Mark, and read Caesar's Messiah, read my book, you can because I think it's clearly enough laid out there. You can just take these events and then actually in the Gospels, and then just look at the parallel that exists in Josephus, or in sometimes not even the parallel, but the actual event itself, like the encircling of Jerusalem with the wall or the raising of the temple. And then you can just see that these events are occurring in the same sequence. And this is, you know, is not circumstantial. Yeah, you can come up with, the explanation of divine prophecy. I would have a hard time disproving this. But I would just point out that the explanation that just, you know, one writer is copying the other is just a little more plausible.
All right, let's bring this thing home with our buddy Stephen Crowder.
And then, who said this? In that case, either Jesus Christ is God in the flesh, the Son of God, a liar, or a crazy person.
Yeah.
Okay, the answer to his question, by the way, is C.S. Lewis. The proposition is so classic modern day Christian apologist. This is reminiscent of the kind of conversation that I've had, you've had, I'm sure many listeners have had over the Thanksgiving dinner table with people who are committed Christians, and you beat them on every point of logic and reason. And then at the end, they come up with this kind of left field argument. If Bart Ehrman's Jesus existed, then why wouldn't we accept? I don't know if you have much to say on that, but.
Well, yeah, I do. I mean, you know, the fact is that this is just atrocious reasoning. There are other possibilities. How about the idea that the character is simply being created for political purpose? In other words, as a way to calm down the problem that existed for Josephus's patrons, which is to say the Messianic movement that was militaristic. When you just put Jesus into the real historical era, then you don't have to think of him as the Son of God. He's really more natural just to understand as a political caricature, right? That is basically there to calm down the Messianic movement. This is really what Jesus becomes when you put him into the real history.
So our guest again has been Joseph Atwell, author of Caesar's Messiah, a book that if you're not familiar with it and you're at all interested about this topic, I definitely would encourage you to pick up and read. But Joe, you've written other books, but more importantly, tell folks what's up now. What's the latest at Post Flaviana? And do you have another book in the works? Because last time I talked to you, you said you do.
I do. It's... Unfortunately, there's been a kind of a new avenue of scholarship that I really wanted to include in this book, which I assure you will be the last one I ever write. So I wanted to finish it up. It basically concludes a kind of trilogy, you know, that starts with Caesar's Messiah. And the final one is called The Secret Language of the Oligarchs and just talks about the modern world and how understanding the symbolism and literary systems in the past enables us to really know a lot about the present. You can buy my books at caesarsmessiah.com. And I also wanted to say that, you know, I really appreciate a chance to talk about these subjects with you. And I know that, that there'll be Christians who hear this discussion and will feel that there are points that, weren't covered. I'm always happy to go on shows, you know, with Christian scholars and discuss these ideas. You can reach me at joeatwell@gmail.com. I mean, one thing, you know, I feel that scholars should do is be open to criticism. And the only reason I like coming on your show is I know I'll get lots of it. And so I want to thank you, Alec, for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again to Joseph Atwell for joining me today on Skeptico. And thanks to Stephen Crowder and Gerald for doing their thing and allowing this kind of conversation discussion to happen. So I guess I'd have one question to tee up from this interview, and that is, does this question matter? Again, at the beginning, I said I sometimes get feedback that I'm hammering this issue to death. Boy, to me, it just seems so central given the role that Christianity and religion continue to play in our culture and the extent to which it's one of the primary drivers of geopolitics. It does seem to me that asking the fundamental questions about the reality of it would be central to all of us. So let me know your thoughts. Of course, the place to do it is at the Skeptico website, skeptiko.com, where you'll find hundreds and hundreds of interviews like this. I do have a number of shows coming up and some other changes coming up as well, but we'll just have to wait and see how all that evolves. Until next time, take care and bye for now.